Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 186 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Bloody, bloody heck. 186. We're so close to 190. And you know what that's close to? 200.
2,453? No.
I don't think we'll do that much.
No. You don't know. We might do that much. And now, on to our read-along. We are discussing chapter 3 again. I can't say it.
You want to be in the 20s.
Good Lord. I just want to
be
20 again.
We both want to be in our 20s. Nah, not 20, like maybe 25.
Well, I'm trying to say 23, so clearly that's where I want to be. Anyway.
That's what you want to be.
Clearly. Okay, this week we will be discussing chapter 33. Actually, I wouldn't mind being 33 again. Chapter 33, entitled Buried Treasure.
Jamie and Claire are back at Lallybroch. Ian and Jamie have their whoopins. And the chapter opens with Jamie and Claire luxuriating and having a warm bed to finally sleep in. Claire compares Jamie to a baboon as he stretches out his long limbs. She's happy that, if nothing else, her advice regarding tooth hygiene or oral hygiene was well heeded. Diana tells us that almost all of the Frasers and Murrays had kept their teeth. Martina P. writes, I love the fact that Jamie follows Claire's health advice and after 20 years still picks up the willow twig to brush his teeth. We learn that all Frasers have beautiful teeth because of Claire's impact. She tells Jamie that a baboon, because Jamie's like, what? She tells him that a baboon is a very large monkey with a red behind. Red, of course, due to young Ian's whooping.
I mean, do we think it was a combination of
His hair?
No, you nasty, nasty.
I didn't know where you were going, because that's what I thought she meant. Lisa T. writes, next we see the animal imagery. It reminds him of John seeing Jamie as a red deer or a stag, and John hunting Jamie after he went searching for the treasure. For the record, Claire is rather bold to go there. I hope it's clean. Nasty, I know. By the same token, the fact that Jamie lets her touch him there shows the trust that he has for her after everything that BJR did to him. Now, what Lisa T is talking about, and what Summer and I, or I should say I, did not detail, is as they're lying there, just relaxed with each other and kind of, I want to say, I guess, getting to know each other again and just being very open and comfortable with each other physically, she kind of, I guess, goes down to finger around.
Finger and that's around?
That's what Lisa T is referring to. I'm not saying that she's saying he's going up the back alley. All I'm saying is she's back there playing around. She's like between there is a line in there somewhere. We know she's near his back end. There's a line in there somewhere about him separating his cheeks to give her access.
I clearly glossed over that because I don't want to read that.
I didn't think it was anything I needed to write notes about. Okay. It was like a love scene. A love scene that lasts like two pages. I mean,
yeah,
I can say
now I've got a visual of him pulling his butt cheeks apart.
Not her, his.
I know. I said pulling his butt cheeks apart.
Oh, I heard her. It dropped out. But if that is indeed what happened, and I believe, I don't know if it went as far. Yeah. See, Lisa's not saying she went internal. Lisa's just saying the fact that he is okay with her being back there at all is pretty amazing, or shows that a lot of trust after, of course, after everything BJR had done to him. So I would agree with that, Lisa. It's funny, this conversation has come up before in Outlander. I think in book one, when Claire disobeyed Jamie and put all the men in danger, even though she didn't understand her actions, Jamie didn't really want to punish her. Ha! He actually did a little bit. But the rest of the men basically shunned her until she was punished. Like in Outlander, once punishment had been meted out, all is right with the world. Their society is restored to balance. So, and that is, of course, I wrote that after the comment about Jamie's red behind. Lisa T writes, "We are back to the theme of punishment from both Outlander and Dragonfly and Amber, though this is a more humorous version on a theme. They discuss how young Ian is different than Jamie's other nephews. He looks like a Murray, though he's a Fraser through and through. This is yet more comparison between him and Jamie." Now, Claire and Jamie, or Jamie and Claire, that sounds weird to say Claire and Jamie. Jamie and Claire go at it rather nicely. Claire says how nice it is to once again have a man's body to touch. They compare amounts of body hair. He intimates that, yes, he thinks he is being hunted now, too, but he doesn't know by whom. But he says he may know why. He reminds Claire of the gossip surrounding the gold that was meant to be sent from France, etc. Though no one knew it back then. He relays the story of meeting with the dying Duncan Kerr. Jamie says he understood some of what Duncan had said, and he truly thought Duncan had meant Claire when he first mentions a white witch, and had all kinds of fantastical thoughts of where she might be and what she might be doing. Eileen P. writes, Jamie's response to Claire's comment about it being good to have a man's body to touch shows he has been a little insecure about whether she still finds him attractive. And during explorations of Jamie's pelt, Claire notes that he has been hunted. Jamie's acknowledgement that he's currently being hunted introduces a mystery and an adventure.
I mean, this is the last bit of calm we're about to get, y'all.
This
exactly. Chapter, it's like this chapter right here is what the Lallybroch section was in book one. But it's one chapter.
I would say book two, too. We don't get much at Lallybroch before that letter comes.
Agreed.
But just a little bit. I think it's even less in book two than it is in book one and three. At least here they have two chapters. I mean, yes, you get a spanking, but look, you're home. You're still, I think he'd better be happy getting a spanking every other week than have the other stuff happen. That's going to be coming. Jopie writes, there are the beginnings of reestablishment of things. Lallybroch as home, Jamie and Jenny's relationship, and further physical explorations and expressions of love for Jamie and Claire as they talk after making love. Hunting comes up again, with Jamie voicing it in jest first. Claire hears the layers under his deprecating joke, and he tells Claire another version of the story of the French gold. There's irony that part of the thing that saved him from transportation, although not the only or even main one, is also the thing that keeps him on the radar, along with smuggling and sedition. As Jamie tells of the White Witch, Claire, in an unusually sentimental moment, wishes it was her. Martina P. writes, I have always enjoyed Jamie's and Claire's time at Lallybroch. Every time they return, they have these precious moments. Jamie shares what happened during his escape from Ardsmuir and the 2 days he spent at the moor. So Jamie had no idea where the gold had come from, but Duncan told him where it was and why it was there. It belonged to the prince. Duncan had talked about silkies and mentioned the name Ellen, and Jamie knew he meant his mother. He went to the one place where it was famed the silkies lived. He'd easily escaped from Ardsmuir. According to Duncan's instructions, the treasure lay on the third island, furthest away from the shore, at this place where everything was, where the silkies lived. He found a location called Ellen's Tower, which guarded a passage down to the beach. He stripped naked and swam to the island. So my question is, does one not get seasick if one swims in the sea, or is that only for being aboard a vessel?
I think it's just being aboard a vessel, because if all bodies of water would have bothered him in a boat. but he didn't have any trouble swimming when he, I was thinking about that myself, but he didn't have any trouble swimming at
the pond.
No, whatever, the place where the water wheel was.
Yeah, the pond, the mill pond. That's true. But that water wasn't moving. I can see the boat, a boat being like
the water mill.
Well, but he wasn't like, I don't know. I just, there's something about the ocean and it's so powerful and it's like, I can't imagine. But again, it could be, I'm not saying it's psychological as in you're lying, but it could be in your mind / inner ear. You know what I mean? And when you're swimming, you're kind of, you're moving, your whole body is moving with it as opposed to separately. I don't know. It's a little bit confusing, but I've been seasick before, but I don't get seasick when I have been in the ocean. So I believe him that he's not. I'm just wondering because he's so freaking sick when he's in a boat and it's just so different. So I'm curious about that. He tells Claire of how he thought he was done for, but after he commended his body to the sea, his mother called to him while he prayed. He swam a bit more, and then he was picked up by the current and taken to the island. As he climbs onto the shore, crawls onto the shore, he sees a bull seal, which, of course, they're very dangerous. And Jamie goes on about all the things he could have done to him, this seal. Claire says, obviously, he didn't, though. What happened? Claire's like, stop telling me what may happen to you. It didn't happen because you're alive. So go on and tell me what the freak is the most important thing. Eileen P. writes, it's nice to know Jamie's mother is the guardian angel and is there to rescue him during his arduous swim to Seal Island. Joe B. writes, what a beautiful recall to Ellen, here where we can see or smell her roses. The seal went back into the water and Jamie had the island to himself. He began to look for the treasure. He eventually looks into the crevices and finds a small hollow near the center of the island. It was a box, less than a foot long, and a small leather pouch. The box had gold and silver coins, ancient coins, Greek and Roman. It was treasure, but not what Louis would have sent. And the pouch had stones in it. Okay, so this, and I don't think, I'm pretty sure I never had this thought before. So this makes me think of Master Raymond. Gold and silver, Roman and Greek coins. The reason, Roman and Greek coins don't make me think of him. But when I hear stones, it makes me think of him, right? Because of, we don't know everything yet, but because there's been some kind of, not for Claire, but some kind of link with, oh, I guess there hasn't been a link yet, has there? Can't say that.
No, but it surely made me think of the collection of coins that Claire purchased before she headed back, which made me think of time traveling.
So you thought of time traveling for a kind of a different reason. I thought of, Master Raymond is a different special biscuit. We don't know that he's a yet, right? So I can't talk about that.
Okay.
Okay. I will say this makes me think of a certain person we met but haven't seen yet in this book. When I read about silver, Roman and Greek, I think silver and gold. So silver and gold, Roman and Greek coins. And the reason they're linked to the person that I'm not going to name, in my brain at least, is because they're old. So being in another time or another space. And then stones, well, of course, precious stones, not time-traveling stones or stones that you would use to travel, but precious stones. So just keep that in mind. We may have an update later. Now then Jamie finds a number of seals around him, so the females. And, of course, the male is back too. He's like, yep, time to get going. He puts the treasure back into its place and swam back to shore, got dressed, and slept a bit. Different from what Jamie told Lord John, right? We thought that he told him that he dumped it, right? And he kept the one just as proof that he had been there.
He said he threw it back in the ocean.
Yeah, he dumped it. That's what I mean. Yeah. Whatever it was, actually, he described kind of the same thing. He described a little casket that had coins in it. Didn't really say what it was, but he did say it wasn't all this bullion. And he just threw it in the ocean. So this is kind of a new development. So for all intents and purposes, for all we know, it's been, what, 10 years since then? Maybe 7-10 years since that happened? Because that was about 10 years after Culloden. So it's been approximately 10 years since. And so, unless someone out there was awfully curious or lucky, That stuff's still there. Eileen P. writes, I laughed out loud when Jamie was surrounded by the harem of seals. They surveyed him. Well, of course they did. He's Jamie Fraser and he was naked. No wonder the bull seal felt threatened. Oh, gosh. And Martina P. writes, I have always enjoyed Jamie's and Claire's time at Lallybroch. Every time they return, they have these precious moments. Jamie shares what happened during his escape from Arsmuir and the 2 days he spent on the moor. We learn about Jamie's dad, Brian, and how he earned his nickname and how Jamie heard his mom's voice while floating on the water prepared to die. Reading this, one question comes to mind. Does Diana want us to believe that Jamie has supernatural powers? I find myself very emotional every time Jamie shares stories about Ellen and Brian. You're not the only one, Martina. So many people want nothing more than that prequel. Because, I mean, that's going to be, it's going to be magic, you know?
It's, yes, I agree with that. Like, I'm very eager for the Brian and Ellen book to be written.
I know.
And I'd be interested if she's ever going to make an appearance in the series itself. I hesitate to even mention it because every time we talk about things that should be in the series, apparently they get not put in.
Oh, you mean like in the television series?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even care. I can't limit myself to what might or might not happen. Claire is astonished. Jamie went back. He explains that not only would others not be safe as long as he was out, but he couldn't have lasted long without support. How could he use that money or the stones? It was too risky, and the English hunted hard. He brings her attention to the panel in the entry hall of Lallybroch. It bore the scars of saber slashes, and they kept them on purpose to remember, to show the children. Jamie was keeping his family safe, those around Ardsmuir safe. Lisa T. writes, I found it interesting that Jamie makes the point to Claire about being in prison and Bree being very young. This also reminds me of what Frank knew. Did he know that Jamie was alive and not tell Claire? Because it would have been impossible for her to live knowing that Jamie was alive and Bree still a child. Could Frank have done this to spare Claire further agony? You're going to get both camps on that. You're going to get the fans of Frank who say yes, or that he didn't know, and the people who are severely anti-Frank, who really hate him or whatever, strongly against him, are going to say, no, he did that on purpose, despite her, you know? So you're going to get all the answers to that question.
I mean, are you asking me?
Well, that was from Lisa. So Lisa's asking us.
Well, there's never been any love lost between me and Book Frank.
but me and Tobias,
That being said, I mean, I love Tobias. I still don't love Frank. No matter what the series people try to do, I don't love him. I don't despise him or actually, no, Book Frank, I honestly don't care about one way or the other. I was not affected by his sudden passing. I was mostly affected with anger when he was threatening to take Brianna away right before his untimely demise.
Or was it timely?
No. Maybe. But that's the only time in reading the books that I actively felt a strong emotion for Frank, other than annoyance. I'm just like, ugh, Frank. But that moment in the book, I actively hated him for that moment.
That moment mesmerizes me because I am not 100%. Could he have been an Icky Day? Yes. I am not 100% convinced that he was being an Icky Day. You know, he was being an Icky Day. I'm not 100% convinced he was not doing it to hide something else.
And I'm sure that's the case. I'm just telling you how that moment as a mother
affected me.
That being said, I do think he found him. And I think he knew that he was alive. But I don't think that he personally fully understood the nature of time travel and whether or not it meant that she could get back to him. So it wouldn't really have mattered had he told her. I mean, it would have mattered because she knew she could possibly get back, but he didn't. I don't think he knew that. So I don't think he was holding that back from her out of anything other than to make sure that he kept Brianna.
Mm. Okay. See, that's what I said. You're going to have answers to that on all sides.
But yes, I think he knew. Bastard.
We see again Jamie's skill as a natural born leader. quote, "And so, quite simply, he had taken the ragtag and remnants, the cast-off survivors of the field of Culloden, and made them his own, that they and he might survive the stones of Ardsmuir as well. Reasoning, charming, and cajoling where he could, fighting where he must, he had forced them to band together, to face their captors as one, to put aside ancient clan rivalries and allegiances, and take him as their chieftain. They were mine, he said softly, and the having of them kept me alive." Unquote. It was as simple as that. And of course, they had been ripped from one another, shipped to the colonies into indenture.
I don't think they gave him a choice about it.
So you don't think that either side had truly, truly a choice?
No, I don't. I don't think that they had a choice. I don't think he had a choice because most of the men were soldiers that had been underneath him in the army already. So they already saw him as an authority figure. And then some of them, I don't know. I don't think any of them were from Lallybroch, right? They were all just...
No.
Yeah. But they were all from the Rising. So they all knew him as an authority figure from that. And, you know, when you get in situations like that, you do tend to not gang up, but, you know, form your cliques. And they were one giant clique in the prison. So I think that the nature of their shared history led itself to that relationship.
Because they were able to not just form under Jamie, but form against a common enemy.
Correct.
Joby writes, using the commonality of their situation, identifying a common enemy, I didn't even read this before, and his own cachet as Red Jamie Fraser, the remnants of the Rising became a clan. The familiar structures and relationships making prison more bearable for Jamie as well as the rest of them. He couldn't abandon what he considered his responsibility. Lisa T. writes, I am always struck by the line, quote, they were mine, and the having of them kept me alive, unquote. It is heartbreaking and powerful. Jamie always takes on so much responsibility for others. He survived by doing exactly that. Martina P. writes, I believe Jamie could have taken the treasure and run with it, but he decided to return to his men in Ardsmuir because he knew they needed him as their leader as much as he needed them to go on. Another very lairdly decision by Jamie Fraser. I do wonder why Jamie does not mention Lord John Grey to Claire. Surely she would have remembered that incident. And by that she means the one where William Grey was the 16-year-old William Grey who came up and Jamie ripped her dress and showed her goodies off and all that in the story, in the book. In the TV show, she acts along, which, not a fan of that, but whatevs. So then Jamie and Claire go on to fiddle diddle again. Joe B. writes, this is also the first time since Claire's return where there is a moment where there is no immediate threat from dodgy customs agents, unknown sailors, and angry siblings.
Yeah, don't get comfortable.
I know. This reminds me of what Elizabeth Gaskell calls at the end of her novel, North and South, delicious silence. Now they are together, there is space to be. And Joe B. says that she recommends both the book and the 2005 BBC adaptation of that. They are wonderful, Joe. I agree. Martina P. writes, throughout this chapter, we see how Jamie and Claire become increasingly closer through tenderness, passion, and conversation. So enjoy these precious, intimate moments, because we know they never last. It's the calm before the storm. Yeah, the last time they were at Lallybroch, when there was any kind of calm, they got a letter in the post, and Jamie screamed like a girl.
I hate it when that happens.
You remember that?
I do.
I know, huh? The next morning, Claire wakes first. Oh my gosh, I just got a picture of what happens the rest of the chapter.
Awful. Oh.
It's the worst thing ever.
It's oh my God. It's the reason that God invented locks on bedroom doors.
Door locks.
Good Lord.
Oh gosh. The next morning, Claire wakes first. She sets to rekindling the fire. As she stands to close the window to keep in the warmth, she sees three ponies coming up over the rise toward the house. they were three women, she can tell, because of their wearing dresses. And she assumes, of course, that it's Maggie, Kitty, and Janet.
It's never safe to assume.
Well, you know what assuming does.
Yes, I do.
Jamie wakes and says he'd been dreaming about food and women. Claire says she hopes he can tell the two apart. Quote, "So long as you don't confuse the two," I said, twitching my shoulder out of his reach. Jamie replies, quote, "I can tell a hawk from a handsaw. When the wind sets north by northwest," he assured me, "and a sweet, plump lassie from a salt-cured ham, too, appearances notwithstanding." Unquote. Lisa T. writes, "The bit about the hawk and the handsaw is from Hamlet. Even though he is blinded by the sun, he can still tell the difference, corruption, of Harrenshaw. There is a bit more to it, but basically most hunters could not, due to the sun's angle and direction. The fact that Jamie can is a testament to his skills." So just as Jamie is going downtown, Judy Brown, and she's, Claire, is splayed for all to see, into their room bounds a young girl Claire has never seen.
Seriously, nightmare. It's my nightmare.
This girl is hoodified. And she looks at Claire and exclaims, "Daddy, who is that woman?"
Ugh. Oh, my God.
Like, I can't even, like, I like how we were both silent there. I mean, they have to keep this because it's too horrifying and comical to not keep. Again, one of those, again, they're probably not going to keep it now.
Seriously.
I just jinxed it.
I can think of no greater mood killer than some random chick coming into the room when you're, you know, diddling your recently reconnected
spouse. This is not diddling.
Ginger, calm down.
Okay.
It's okay. I can think of nothing worse than getting down with whoever, somebody you're just recommitting yourself to, and having not only a strange woman or girl walk into the room, but then to also call them daddy it's just too many. It's like,
it's too many layers.
Too many layers of awful.
Of awfulness.
It's like,
Oh, yeah. Anne S. writes, "This whole section has some of my favorite scenes of quiet, earnest conversations and reflections, mostly between Jamie and Claire, that I love so much about these books. They are still getting used to each other again, exploring what the last 20 years has meant to the other, while still not able to completely open up."
I'm pretty sure that what he's exploring at the end of this chapter had nothing to do with the last 20 years.
"While still not able to completely open up about their time apart, they can connect the way they know best and can be fully open physically."
Oh, God. It's like everything she just said.
I know.
Everything about the end of this chapter that is so awful.
Anne continues, "Jamie has had many names, many identities, many roles, but the one thing they all have in common is Jamie as leader, protector, and provider. He is willing to sacrifice his body, his morals, and his freedom if he can provide for others. He is truly lost without being able to fulfill his role." And then reality comes crashing through the bedroom door. "Daddy." A little warning would have softened this blow to Jamie.
How about a knock? How about a knock?
That's what I'm thinking. I know. Eileen P. writes, "Oh, the horror of walking in on your parents when they are having sex. But wait, that's not your mother. And the quote-unquote other woman has no idea her lover, who is her husband, has a daughter by another woman. The daughter is 15 or 16, which means she was conceived when Jamie lived in the cave, but before Jamie was with Mary McNabb. Jamie, you have some splaining to do." Joe B. writes, "The next morning, Claire sees horses in the distance. Three, not the four of the apocalypse, which seems too good a visual cue to have missed, really. However, in a scene that recalls the beginning of episode 10 of the TV series, Jamie and Claire's good morning is again interrupted. In a scene I am very much looking forward to, by an outraged girl who calls Jamie daddy." Yes, so Jamie's in the cookie jar again, but this time it's not Myrta, it's a little 15 or 16-year-old girl who calls Jamie daddy.
Now I kind of want to hear Duncan LaCroix call him daddy.
Oh gosh, daddy. No, that's bad. Lisa T. writes, "It's bad enough that they were interrupted, but to be in the middle of that and completely naked is just mortifying. It is ironic that they should be caught while Jamie is pleasuring Claire when she is most vulnerable and quite literally exposed, as opposed to having sex where his body might, depending on the position, of course, cover hers. Just a wee thought.
Seriously.
And it looks like time just ran out for Jamie.
Oh my God, the more we talk about this, the more awkward it feels.
Oh, one more person.
Oh God, come on, people.
Martina P. writes, oh, this is great. Martina P. writes, I need to share a personal story in reference to the cliffhanger of this chapter. When I read this book 2 years ago, entirely unspoiled and blissfully unaware of any Outlander social media sites of any kind, I came upon the last sentence. Daddy, who is that woman? Totally engaged in the story, I froze and dropped my iPad onto the bathroom tiles. Needless to say, my iPad screen was shattered into pieces, and I was frantically trying to read through the cracks, however, without success. I ran around like a chicken without a head, finally got into my car and purchased a brand new iPad. 2 hours later, I was back on the couch to continue with chapter 34. I was in no condition to feed my family that evening. So... Not only is that an awesome story, Martina, we love it when you guys share things like that, little quintessential, like real life Outlander connection moments, or maybe not connection, but real life moments where Outlander has affected you positively or negatively in some way. And that was awesome because number one, you're sharing. Number two, I could not imagine, thank God there were no such thing as iPads or phones when... No, cell phones existed. Cell phones definitely existed when we found these books or when I read the books, but or in the very beginning. But nothing like glass, like the glass faces and the cases and nothing like today's. And so, yeah, I could only imagine. Could you imagine, like, if you were reading it, something that shocked you so much you dropped your iPad?
Yeah, the most that I've gotten is, like, chucking my book across the room. I can't imagine.
Oh, like DIA?
Yes.
Would you have dropped your iPad?
I don't know, but I get nervous when anyone starts to talk about electronics in a bathroom.
Oh yeah, me too.
And that made me think of that meme that was going around that said, "So I'm glad I don't have a thigh gap. I almost dropped my phone in my toilet, but my legs were like, nah, girl, we got you."
I think I sent that to you.
I think you did.
That, oh my God, that made me laugh so hard. Nah, girl, we got you. Oh, Lord. So there's one way, ladies, that a thigh gap can be protective.
No, not having a thigh gap can work in your favor. Having a thigh gap can be detrimental to the health of your phone.
I'm backwards. Having one, so I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm backwards. I see. Yes, not having one. So having healthy thighs can save your phone.
That's right.
Okay, so I'm safe. Are you good?
I'm good. I'm good.
So, dear,
I've always been good. I've never not been good.
We hope. That's a little TMI.
So that was chapter 33. Join us next week when we discuss chapter 34, entitled Daddy, and 35, Flight from Eden.
Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.